Well, for about the last 4.5 months, we have been taking a long, slow slog through the book of Genesis, the first 11 chapters. That's way slower than we normally go, and there's been a reason for it. What we wanted to do was touch on all the topics that concern creation. We have talked about astronomy and cosmology. Ay, ay, ay. We've talked about biology and chemistry. We've talked about many things. And the reason that we've been taking time and doing this is because I don't ever want a Christian to be ashamed to take a stand on God's Word. I want every Christian high school student in the classrooms, every Christian student in college, I want you as you talk to your friends and neighbors to be able to take a stand on God's Word and say, you know what? There aren't two stacks of evidence, one for creation and one for evolution. There's one stack of evidence, one set of data. And depending on the presuppositions you bring to the facts, you will see different things. And we wanted to equip you to know that the facts very capably show that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. So we've taken our time and done that 4.5 months, and today we're to chapter 11. Chapter 11 forms a natural break in the book of Genesis. Up to this time, we've been talking about creation, the garden, the pre-flood world, the flood, and now the Tower of Babel. After this, we're going to get into the life story of a man named Abraham. So today is one last little science lesson, an easy one in the study of languages. Today, we're going to study two more beginnings. We have seen the creation of the universe, the stars, and the earth. We've seen the creation of man and the first man and woman in the garden. We've seen the story of the garden, the history of the fall, and the history of the flood. Today, two more beginnings. We're going to look at the origins of human language, and we're also going to look at the first organized rebellion that man leads against God. We're going to watch as God separates the nations of the earth by their languages. And then we're going to track the line that leads to one man, a man named Abram, because that is the line through which God will bring the Messiah into the world. So, we're in Genesis chapter 11, a little study on language this morning, as we look at something called the Tower of Babel. Verse number 1 reads this way. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. At this point in time, there is one language on the face of the entire planet. That language was spoken by Adam in the garden. It was spoken by Adam and his sons after the fall. It was spoken by all those pre-flood generations. And after the flood, it was spoken by Noah, his sons, and their sons for a time. Some people believe that that language was Hebrew. And there's a possibility that it might have been. Because you remember back in Genesis 5 when we did that genealogy, all the names in the line of Adam, Adam, Seth, and so on and so on. All those names had a meaning. They told the story of the gospel if you read them in Hebrew. So it's possible that original language on the earth was Hebrew, or maybe it was a root form of Hebrew that Hebrew developed from. But whatever the language was, there was only one tongue spoken by every human being on the planet. It said, as they came to pass, they journeyed from the east, and they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. There's a problem with that verse, because the land of Shinar is the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. It's an area that we know today by the name of Iraq. And if you look at Mount Ararat in Turkey, you'll find that Mount Ararat is not east of Shinar. It's directly north of it. And so what's the deal there? Well, some people believe that the ark landed somewhere in the mountains of Iran, and that from Iran they traveled from the east and came to Shinar, Babylon. Other folks think that as they came off of the ark and they kind of moved down the slopes of Mount Ararat, that a great group of them traveled out to the east and went to Iran and kept traveling until they found better territory, finally came to the plain of Shinar. Doesn't matter much for our purposes today. We just need to know that this was occurring after the flood, at a time when the whole of humanity all spoke one language. Coming from the east, they came to this plain of Shinar, what we would call Iraq, and there they dwelt, modern-day Babylon. Verse 3 takes us into a little information about the tower that was built there. Then they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." Now think back for a minute. Before the flood, when it was time to board the ark, God said, "Come into the ark." After the ark had landed, when it was time to leave, God said, "Go and replenish the earth." In other words, as the Three Stooges would have put it, spread out. And go everywhere. Fill the whole earth. Go to all the lands and repopulate this planet again. Now, God's command was, go. And so man's response was, come. Lest we be scattered. Unless the thing that God said should happen to us. God said, go, scatter, go everywhere. And man said, come, let us gather together, lest we be scattered. And let us build a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Remember the name of the man who established that city there? Man named Nimrod, right? Remember what his name means. Let us rebel. The thing that had happened after the ark, between Noah and his son Ham, the incident of drunkenness and the rejoicing over it. Remember that Noah had spoken a curse on Ham's son Canaan. And it's not a far stretch of the imagination to think that as Ham's children and Canaan's children and Cush's children all grew up hearing about this curse on the family, they must have got awful tired of that. Well, why should we be cursed, you know? Yeah. And so they rebelled against the judgment of God and named one of their children, "Let us rebel." Nimrod. Nimrod begins establishing cities. He establishes Babel on the site of modern-day Babylon. He establishes Assyria and Nineveh. And he builds the first kingdom. And this is the first organized rebellion of man against God. Before this, before the flood, yes, there was sin on the earth. But for the first time, man gathers together and says, "Come, let us build ourselves a city. Tower whose top reaches into heaven, lest we be scattered," just as God had said. And so God says, go, and they say, come. God says, spread out, and they say, let's not get scattered. And they decide to build a city. And we know that city today. They called it Babel. Today we know it by a different name, Babylon. This is, other than Genesis chapter 10, the first mention of this city that you're going to find in the Bible. We're going to run across this city again and again and again, all throughout the Old Testament, and we're going to run across it in the New Testament as well. When you hear the name Babylon, there needs to be an immediate response in your mind. You need to think rebellion against God, because that's what the city of Babylon represents. So every time you see it in the Old Testament, every time you see it in the New Testament, it represents man's rebellion against God's rule. Actually, the story of the Bible is the story of two cities. It's the story of Babylon and Jerusalem. Babylon being man's city, opposed to God, and Jerusalem being God's city, given by God to his people, Israel. Every time we see this city, it's going to be opposed to God. When Israel falls into sin, and God judges them for their sins, he uses Babylon to take them into captivity. And there they stay for 70 years. Until God moves against Babylon and frees them. Babylon is, there is a great deal of prophecy that has to do with Babylon in the Bible. One of the things concerning Babylon is that it will be utterly destroyed and it will be inhabited no more forever. Now, in our day today, that prophecy is not true yet. Because Babylon has not been destroyed utterly. You can go to Iraq today and find it. It's there. And people live there. Question could arise in your mind, wait a minute, what happened when God freed the Israelites and took them out? Wasn't Babylon destroyed then? And the answer is no. Because you remember what happened. Babylon was surrounded by a set of walls that was so thick and so high, they were considered for all practical purposes impregnable. The walls were so thick that when they got bored, they would hold chariot races, six chariots abreast on top of the walls. And it covered an area. If you went from Ranchos up to up into El Prado, that wall went all around that whole area and closed an entire city. It was considered so impregnable that they didn't even worry about defending it. In the days of Belteshazzar, he was having a drunken party when the Medes and the Persians were gathered outside the city. He felt that confident. And the Medes and Persians, they said to themselves, okay, too thick to go through, too high to go over, so we'll go under it. And that's what they did. Because the source of water for the city was a river that was passing under the city wall and then coming into the city, providing them with fresh water in times of siege. So the Medes and Persians went upstream, dammed the river, and when it dried up, they walked on the dry riverbed under the walls and came in, surprised Belteshazzar and his guys, and took over the city so thoroughly and so sneakily that for 3 days, people who lived in the city didn't even know they'd been conquered. It was that much of a peaceful takeover. And so on October 12th, 539 BC, Babylon fell without a single arrow being fired. And the city continued and people lived in it. Later on, when a man named Alexander the Great came through the area and conquered in the name of Greece, he took Babylon as his capital city. And he lived in it, and that's where he died. By the time the 1800s rolled around, archaeologists wanted to go there and do digs. And in 1820, an archaeologist went to Babylon and hired local residents to help him dig. So this city has not been destroyed in our day. It has not been forgotten, and it's still being inhabited. In fact, today, if you go to Iraq, you can see the modern-day city of Babylon that Saddam Hussein built. And it's filled with buildings that were built and used for state ceremonies and services. Saddam Hussein was so proud to have rebuilt Babylon that he offered an award. He said, if anyone can figure out how the ancient Babylons watered those incredible hanging gardens using ancient technology, $1 million. And so this city has been rebuilt and it's still inhabited today. God's promise was that the city would be utterly destroyed and that it would never be inhabited again. Let me take you a few places in Scripture and show you these promises just very briefly and establish this. First place I'm going to turn is Isaiah 21, verse 9. God uses the prophet Isaiah to speak a judgment against Babylon. And in verse 9 are these words, and we'll read them again later in the book of Revelation. And look, here comes a chariot of men with a pair of horsemen. And he answered and said, Babylon is fallen, and all the carved images of her gods he has broken to the ground. Later in the days of another prophet, the prophet Jeremiah, in chapter 50 of Jeremiah's book, in verse 39, we read these words. Therefore the wild desert beasts shall dwell there with the jackals, and the ostriches shall dwell in it. It shall be inhabited no more forever, nor shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. As God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah and their neighboring cities, says the Lord, so no one shall reside there, nor son of man dwell in it. And how thorough was God when he wiped out Sodom and Gomorrah? They're still looking for it today, can't find it. Well, that's exactly what's going to happen to Babylon. It has not happened yet. The city still stands. It's still inhabited. But God's word promises us that a day is coming when that city will be utterly destroyed and never lived in again. That day will come at the end of human history, at the end of a period of time called the Great Tribulation, after the church has been taken to heaven to the marriage of the Lamb in an event called the Rapture. After 7 years of wrath and judgment of God poured out on a world that has rejected Christ, at the end of that period of time, God will move finally against Babylon, this representation of man's rebellion against God. And we find that event chronicled for us in Revelation chapter 18. Verse number 1 reads like this. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a habitation of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. Continuing on in verse 9, it says, and the kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Skipping ahead to verse 17. For in 1 hour such great riches come to nothing. And every shipmaster, all who travel by ship, sailors, and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what is like this great city? And they threw dust on their heads and cried out, weeping and wailing, and saying, alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she's made desolate. Finally, verse 21, then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found anymore. Now those words are not true in our day, because Babylon's standing, it's inhabited. God's promise is it will be utterly and finally destroyed and never lived in again. So today in Iraq stands a city that was founded on the same location that Nimrod built his original city, Babel. In the end times, that city will become a great commercial, religious, political center for the entire planet again, in a rebellion against God. And God will judge that city in 1 hour. Some people, as they see that, see the supernatural hand of God coming against Babylon, judging it, just as he judged Sodom and Gomorrah. Some people in that see that end battle that we refer to as Armageddon, and see the use of nuclear weapons taking out this great city. And therefore the merchants all stand at a distance, all terrified of it, no one going near it, saying, alas, in 1 hour it's made desolate, burned to the ground. But by whatever means it's taken down, God's promise is that the city will be utterly wiped out and will not stand again, not ever in history. Not true today. But whenever you now read about the city of Babylon in the Bible, Old Testament or New, you need to think in your mind, man's rebellion against God, the city that's opposed to God's city, that will lead a final rebellion against God, and this great commercial, political, religious center will be taken out by God and completely and forever destroyed. Now, with that cheerful little wind-up, back to the text, verse 3. Nimrod builds a city and a tower. This shows us that these ancient people, they were no slouches. When we think of the ancient peoples, often we think of folks living in caves or simple huts, maybe after long periods of time, developing metalworking and bronze and things. But these were people that developed a great city. They baked bricks in furnaces. They used asphalt from the pits in Iraq for mortar to cement them together. And they made a tower whose top is in heaven and made a name for themselves, lest they be scattered over the face of the whole earth. You see, Nimrod was no dummy. He knew that if you wanted to organize people and get them together, you needed a rallying point, something they could see, a symbol to gather them around. And so he builds this enormous tower. This is what's known as a ziggurat. You find these all over the ancient world. And usually they were built for celestial observations. The one that we're talking about here, lest anybody think that it's simply fictional, was written about by the Greek historian Herodotus back in the 5th century BC. Herodotus had occasion to travel through this area, and he passed through the ancient city of Babylon. He describes a structure that he saw there 5 centuries before Christ, that had 8 separate levels to it. That much of it was still standing in the days of the Greeks. Those 8 levels stood 60 meters high, and in today's language, That equals a 20-story building, still standing in the days of the Greeks. When these ziggurats were established, they were meant to be used to observe the heavens. We talked in Genesis 1 about the stars, how God put them in the sky for signs and for seasons, remember? And we said that the original intent of the constellations was for signs and for seasons. The way to understand the constellations is not the pictures that they are supposed to form. Because how many of you can look in the sky and see the things that the stars are supposed to make? They don't look at all like archers or women sitting in chairs, do they? The pictures, that's not the secret to it. To understand the constellations, you need to understand that the original intent was something called the Maseroth. And that was looking at each constellation by constellation, taking the brightest star, looking at the name of that star in Hebrew, second brightest star, name of that star in Hebrew, and as you did that through the 12 constellations, it told the story of redemption. It told the gospel of Jesus Christ. What happened was that as Nimrod organized mankind into a rebellion against God, he established this tower not just as a rallying point, but also for heavenly observations. And he took the Maseroth and corrupted it and handed it back to mankind in the form of something we know today as astrology. So all the astrological signs, all the stuff in the newspapers, finds its origin with a man named Nimrod in a city named Babel who was leading a rebellion against God. So Nimrod establishes his great tower and his great city. And this is man's first organized rebellion. This is man's best effort against God. 5 centuries before Christ, there's still 20 stories of it standing. It's man's best effort to reach up into the heavens. And now I want you to look at how God views man's best effort. Verse number 5. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. Listen, you got to love that, man. If you don't think God has a sense of humor and the Bible's not funny, you're not paying attention. Man's best efforts. Come, let us gather together, build a tower whose top reaches into heaven. And God says, I'll come down and look at that. Now, we know that this is intended as humor for us because God is omnipresent. He's everywhere at once. So when they laid the first brick at Babel, was God standing there watching? Of course he was. So when he says, let us come down, he's giving you some information. Your best efforts fall short, kid. So the Lord said, you gotta love it. Let us come down, see the city and the tower which the sons of men have built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord looks at man's rebellion, looks at what he's accomplishing, ancient man accomplishing incredible things, and he says, going to do anything they want now. So let's go down there. And in an effort to keep them from communicating with each other and to keep them from cooperating with each other, let's confuse their languages. And you can imagine what it must have been like. Let's say that, I don't know when it was done, but let's say it was done on the weekend. So, works out. Everybody's at home having a fine old time, hanging out with the wife and the kids, little volleyball, whatever they did back then, I don't know. Monday morning comes. They all show up for work. And the foreman greets the first crew on the scene and says, good morning, how you doing? And the answer comes back, oh, ni hao ma. And he listens, what in the world is that? Turns to the guy next to him and says, did you hear that crazy guy? And he goes, hola, que pasa? What in the world's going on here? Turns to his other buddy and says, can you believe these guys over here? Comment allez-vous? And of course, it wasn't modern languages they were speaking. It was ancient languages, but you get the idea. Suddenly, no one understands each other. And as they begin to deal with this, there's a certain level of frustration as you're trying to get these guys to work together, and nobody speaks the same lingo anymore. And frustration after a short time leads to anger. Come on, you guys, knock it off. What are you trying to pull here? Quit the baloney already. Start talking whatever it is we talk. And after a while, when they realize this isn't going to change, we're all speaking, never heard of it before, but different languages. Suddenly mistrust grows up as, you know, one group looks at the other group and says, those guys over there, man, talk that weird stuff. Can't understand a thing those idiots say. Let's move over here by ourselves. And what happened was that the family groups of the world began to spread out away from each other in mistrust and alienation. It's estimated. No, I'm not going to go there yet. Let me hang on to that for just a minute. Here's the bottom line. God's plan to achieve his original goal of having man spread around the earth again, frustrated by man's rebellion, is going to be fulfilled when God confuses their languages, and on their own, they now begin to move away from each other because they can't understand each other anymore. Verse 8 says, so the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore, its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. And so that original city was called Babel. And in the Babylonian, that means, you guys are familiar with the El part of that now, you know that means God. Babel means gate of God, a tower whose top reaches into heaven. Only in the Hebrew it has another meaning. It means total and utter confusion. And that's a word that we've even borrowed from those ancient languages. Because today if somebody's talking and they're making no sense, we say that they are babbling. So it's an ancient word that we've borrowed and we use it now in English. And this is the origin of the languages of mankind. Today, if you go over the face of the world and take a census, you'll find that there are approximately, a little more, but approximately 6,000 different languages in the world. It's not necessary, however, that all those languages started at Babel. It's only necessary that the major people groups each got a tongue. And if you think of Noah and his sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, and their sons, you know, starting a few people groups, maybe as many as a dozen major groups of people, God only had to start with maybe a dozen, 12, 13 major language groups. And from those groups would come all the ancient languages. And from those ancient languages would come the languages that we know today, the modern languages. Now, evolutionary theory says that this isn't how it happened. Evolutionary theory says that there were some monkeys who got smart. And in order to become better hunter monkeys, they decided to start communicating with each other and they invented language. And let's say a snake was coiled up in the grass and you didn't want your buddy to move because it might strike him, you would make the snake sound. So you would go, shh. And your buddy would get very quiet and very still and he wouldn't get snake bit. And from those simple grunts and simple sounds came all the modern words that we use today. However, what God has shown us in the book of Genesis is that language is a gift to man from God. It was given to him complete and fully formed, and God and man spoke together and communicated. Evolutionary theory would tell us, as it does with other things, that you start with the simple things, and over time they become more complex. And according to evolutionary theory, the way language started was there were some monkeys somewhere who got smart, and they started grunting and shing and making different signs and sounds. And eventually, out of that original, very, very simple kind of communication, began to branch out and form all the languages that we know today. And to help you see that this stuff hurts my head. Does this stuff hurt your head? I hope it does, because then I'll feel dumb compared to y'all. But when I study this stuff, it hurts my head. So I got pictures so that I can see it. We like pictures. We love pictures. So according to evolutionary theory, this is what the development of language looks like. You have a trunk. This is a picture of a tree, just a bare tree and branches. The trunk at the bottom, the single trunk, represents a common ancestral language developed by very early man. And all the branches and branchlets and twigs that come off represent the development of language over time. So down here at the bottom, ground level, a common ancestor language. Here at the top, all the modern languages that we have. But when they examine languages, they don't find a common ancestor. They find a number of language groups that all seem to have arisen about the same time, probably about the time a guy named Nimrod built a tower in a place called Babel. And ancient language development looks more like this. This is called the Genesis Orchard because it's composed of a number of trees. And here at the bottom, you have different language groups that have no connection to each other. And out of these language groups, out of all these trees, these branches represent the development of ancient into modern languages. So when they examine language, they don't find a common ancestor and many coming out. They find many ancestors, none of them having anything to do with each other. They all appear fully formed, just as God gave them to the language and family groups at Babel. Evolutionary theory would say that you start with the simple and you proceed to the complex. And yet when we study ancient languages, we do not find simple languages. And when we study modern languages, we do not find complex languages. Quite the reverse. The ancient languages, when you go back to the really early ones, ancient Chinese, Egyptian hieroglyphics, cuneiform, Phoenician, Sumerian, when you go back to the ancient languages, you find extremely complex grammars and syntaxes. When you come forward to modern languages, you find simple languages. Do you doubt that? Today, in modern English, when you greet someone, you might say, "Yo, sup?" "Hey, dog." When you examine ancient languages, you find extremely complex languages. English, in the time since its development to today, has lost over 65% of its original words. It's not becoming more complex, it's becoming simpler. Anybody ever remember reading in high school or college Chaucer's Canterbury Tales? You remember that thing? You can't even understand that today. Language has changed that much, and it's not evolving and becoming more complex, it's devolving and becoming more simple. Here's an example. Take someone with an ancient language that hasn't had contact with modern society for century after century after century. Go to Australia, take an Aboriginal bushman with an ancient, complex language. Bring them to America, teach them a modern, simple language like English. And they won't be able to get what you're saying. Because you make a statement to an Aboriginal bushman, you say something like, "The man plays the piano." And the bushman will look at you and he'll just shake his head, he doesn't get it. Because in English, we have a word, man. But in his language, much more complex than ours, they have many words. They have a word for a man that you know very well, and he's your friend. They have another word in this ancient language for a man that you know very well, and he's not your friend, he's your enemy. They have another word for a man that you know reasonably well. There's a complete another word for a guy that you know of by name only and you could see him by sight, but you've never talked to him, and he's just a man. And there's another word for a guy that's a stranger. You've never seen him before. He's just passing through. They have all these words for man. And we just say, "The man." They would say, "Which man? Is it the man you know really well and like, the man you know really well and hate, the man you sort of know a little bit, the man you know by sight, the man you've never seen before, the man that's passing through? Which man are you talking about?" You would drive the bushman crazy with English. And then you get to the piano part and he'd say, "Which piano?" Because you teach him that when you take the article "the" and put it with a noun, that means a specific one. And they see they have different words for piano. There's the piano that's brand new and never been touched. There's the piano that's brand new and been played. There's the piano that's been played a lot and taken good care of and looks pretty good. There's the piano that's been played to death and it's fallen apart. There's the piano that is laying out in the sun, rotting and turning into splinters. And they would say, "Which piano?" Which way? And so you say, "The man plays the piano," and they go, "What in the world are you talking about?" Because our language is so simple and theirs are so complex. Language is not evolving, it is devolving. Ancient languages are incredibly complex. Now, if the Bible's right, and God's never wrong, man at the Tower of Babel broke into those major family groups according to their languages. Those languages they received directly from the Lord, fully formed, no common ancestry, and that's exactly what we find when we examine ancient languages today. We find something like the Genesis Orchard, many languages coming up simultaneously, no connection between them, and modern languages coming from them. And today we have language groups. For example, there's one language group called the Indo-European language group. From that language group came a lot of the ancient languages we know of today. Languages like Sanskrit, languages like Latin and Greek. As those ancient languages developed, we got some of the more modern languages from them. We know that German and French and Spanish and Italian, all those borrow heavily from the Latin.